is The Guardian.
I'm Noor Haider, coming to you from Gadigal land, and this is The Full Story. Australians are feeling worse and worse about their own economic security and well-being.
Look at what's happening with One Nation, and when you look at how the economy is talked about, how it's reported on, it feels very disconnected from people's lives.
As future rate hikes are still on the cards.
The workers are the ones who have to shoulder the burden. Workers are the ones who are not being thought of when the elite institutions, whether it be the Reserve Bank or even governments.
It's Monday, the 22nd of June.
In a world of need, we need medical care. Without delay.
Delay.
Without bias. Without bureaucracy. Without prejudice. That's why we need Doctors Without Borders. Save lives at msf.org.au.
Welcome back to Full Story, Grogs.
Great to be here, Noor.
This month, we heard Anthony Albanese wheel out an old political catchphrase in response to a question about what was driving voters towards One Nation. He said, "It's the economy, stupid." So, Grogs, can you give us a snapshot of the state of the economy right now?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing because there's just a lot of moving parts at the moment, and it's not surprising that people were feeling a bit unanchored and uncertain about how things are going. This year, we've had three interest rate rises in a row. It was kind of weird when we just had the one this week where they didn't raise interest rates. When I was writing my column, I was like, oh, wait on, that's the first time this year they haven't raised interest rates. That's astonishing, really. Mm. At the same time, you've got inflation has been high, but for weird reasons, some of it to do with the end of electricity rebates that are just affecting the actual figures. But then you've also got the war in Iran, the Strait of Hormuz affecting oil prices that's flowing on to petrol and other costs. And then you've got fertilizer and all that. So it's kind of like, yeah, we got inflation, but it doesn't seem to feel like it's due to an exuberance on our part where we're all out there getting great wage rises and we're all spending madly. No, it's something from overseas. So you feel like, well, that's not fair.
Mm.
We also see unemployment has risen and it rose in April to 4.5%. And then a week later, in the first week of May, the Reserve Bank raised interest rates again. You think, well, again, that's not fair. So you're like, where am I in this picture? And so it's not surprising, I think, that people are feeling a bit unsure about everything and not quite believing the lines that actually things are doing okay because their lived experience is not.
Okay, there's a lot in that I want to unpack with you, Grogs. One of the moving parts that you referred to was the US war with Iran. Donald Trump said that his so-called peace plan with Iran will avert a worldwide depression. The Australian government for months has been pointing the finger at Washington and Tehran for the economic disruption that we're feeling at home, for the financial pressures that people are feeling. When will the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz be felt here?
Yeah, that's a good question because, one, we got to remember we're dealing with Donald Trump, and even if there is an agreement signed, is it going to actually hold? Is it going to stick? Because we know Iran certainly believes that Israel's attacks on Lebanon are part of the deal, whereas Israel and the US don't seem to think that. So who knows? But let's assume, which is very brave of us, that this deal actually does work and everything open. It's, you know, it's going to take a long time because we've had, what are we, 3 months, 4 months of backlog, essentially.
Mm.
And it's not like that all returns. Now, the good thing is that the oil prices, even before the agreement, had already sort of started coming down. Here at home, our petrol prices are pretty low, and even once the government gets rid of the halving of the fuel excise, they'll roughly be where they were when the Iran war started. Other things where it's going to be really interesting is things like fertilizer. How long is it going to take for the cost of that to return? You know, that's where you see a real long tail, because it's the use of fertilizer now that affects things in a few months' time when the crops are actually starting to come in. And, you know, if crops are down or the cost of fertilizer to produce those crops has increased, then that flows through into prices later on. And so I think it will take a while. And certainly even, you know, in the budget figures, the IMF and OECD, they're all sort of thinking even the best of cases, we'll probably for the rest of this year, we're still going to be feeling the ripples flow through.
Mm. You mentioned the fuel excise. The government says it's still mulling over whether to extend the cut to the fuel excise. Do you think that that's needed?
Look, I don't think so. Yeah, it is costly. We're talking $2.5 billion for 3 months. They could have done some things in the budget to help pay for that, mm-hmm. whether it was the gas tax or whether it was reducing the fuel tax credits that go to mining companies and things like that. They get around $5 billion a year, so we could have paid for it with that. But there's also the politics, though, of keeping it keeps people kind of happy, because it will go up 23 cents a litre as soon as you do it. What they might be hoping is that oil prices will keep going down now that a deal has been done. The excise did its job in kind of keeping inflation down in a period where it would have been rising. It protected consumers from something that they had nothing to do with. But with my economist hat on, I sort of say, yeah, enough's enough. Keep it temporary. But that political thing is knowing that as soon as you do it, you're basically telling everyone you're paying 23 cents a litre more for your petrol.
Mm. I want to shift focus to some of the budget backlash. The government said it wanted to address intergenerational inequality in its budget through the changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax, which you mentioned earlier. But for weeks, it's been forced to defend the plans that they announced in the budget. And then late last week, the Prime Minister backed down on some of the government's proposed changes. They'll now be expanding the capital gains tax exemptions to small businesses with a turnover up to 10 million, and there'll be carve-outs for some startups. I wonder what you think about the pressure that the government has faced in the weeks since the budget.
Yeah, it's been, I think, pretty intense and some levels very absurd. The number of stories, you know, I saw one last week in ABC. So we're not just talking the Australian and the AFR and other conservative sort of outlets. The ABC reporting on an 18-year-old who was looking to buy his first property, an investment property no less, but because of the changes, he was going to hold off on buying a property for a few months. I'm thinking, hang on, can someone step back and just point out that we're talking about an 18-year-old here? You know, this is just absurd. But you do wonder why they didn't sort of anticipate it. Mm. So I think the pressure there has been strong. I think they're doing okay on the housing side of things. I think the government is loving reading stories about, oh, auction numbers are down, but that's because the investors have all gone and first home buyers are suddenly able to bid against each other. I think they're loving those stories, but it is a bit tougher when you get small business owners complaining and, you know, that kind of flows through because they know, you know, someone's at getting their hair done and the small business owner is cutting your hair or doing your hair and they'll probably be chatting about things going, oh, this is going to hurt us and I'm not sure what I'm going to do. And, you know, that kind of thing filters through. So I think it was fairly smart of the government to make these changes. They'll say this is how a mature government does things, by consulting and changing things. What I'm wondering as well is maybe they did anticipate it and this is what they wanted to be able to back down to, rather than they knew if they'd put in the 10 million threshold anyway, they were still going to get complaints and would have had to give up more than they wanted. I wonder if that was something as well. I don't know. But yeah, it's been pretty vociferous, I think, the attacks.
Yeah, and Jim Chalmers has said that he concedes that the government's lost some political paint over the budget changes. But I do want to turn to the RBA. You mentioned that they held the cash rate at 4.35%, but there have been three rate rises through the year, and there are warnings of potentially more to come. In a column for The Guardian, you wrote that the RBA governor has made it clear that the cash rate has been increased not to reduce inflation, but to make it harder to bargain for higher wages. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it was kind of weird back in May when they last raised interest rates. She pointed to inflation is rising due to what's happening in Iran, the Strait of Hormuz and oil prices. And she said, you know, these interest rate rises will not affect that. And it's like, okay, you've just admitted you're increasing interest rates to not affect inflation over, I think she said, over the next 6 months. And then she explained why she's doing it, is that she was worried, and the Reserve Bank is always worried about this, is that when the Iran crisis was averted, things are kind of back to normal, that unemployment would be too low, which would mean too many people have got a job, which means that everyone's feeling a bit too secure and thinks, yeah, let's bargain for a higher wage growth. And rather, she would prefer that by the time everything is cleared up from Hormuz and inflation is back down, that everyone's a bit more worried about keeping their job. And so the pressure to get higher wages is lower because you're like, oh, I better just be sure that I can keep my job rather than get a wage rise. It's always how the Reserve Bank thinks. They're continually worried that there's going to be a wage price spiral, that somehow workers are going to get this magic power to actually bargain for higher wages, and that as a result, companies will raise prices to cover those, and then other workers will go, oh, inflation's gone up, so I'll ask for more wages, I'll get them, and off we go, and it's the 1970s again. Mm. And I kind of, in my column, looked at, well, where's the evidence here? Household spending is pretty weak. In fact, the big driver of household spending has been essential items like electricity. Now, that had nothing to do with excess demand. And if you look at sort of that non-essential spending, which is the type of thing you do when you're feeling kind of flush with cash, well, that's been quite pathetic in the last 9 months. So that's not a sign of excess demand. Wage growth is not picking up. It's actually slowing. So that's not a sign. And if you look at investment, all the investment was coming from AI machinery and equipment. If you take that away, the investment is actually quite low. And it's like, well, is that AI data centers? Are they really powering excess demand? Not really. They're all from imports. They don't employ a lot of people. And most of the profits even a lot of the IP goes overseas. So I'm like, what are you looking at here? And it seems to be their belief is just that because inflation is above 3%, there must be excess demand. Unemployment must be too low. So we got to do something about that. And I think, gosh, that feels very 1970s thinking, and it's time to stop.
We'll be right back.
In a world of need, we need medical care. Without delay.
Delay.
Without bias. Without bureaucracy. Without prejudice. Without silence.
Civilians are not.
Save lives at msf.org.au.
Full Story is supported by EY Parthenon. EY Parthenon is the global strategy consulting practice of EY, working with CEOs, boards, investors, and governments on their most critical decisions. They bring deep sector expertise, an investor mindset, and advanced technology to bring clarity to complex challenges. EY Parthenon helps leaders make better decisions in moments of change, anticipating what's next, finding opportunity in uncertainty, and translating complex shifts into real-world outcomes, turning insight into action. For more insights, go to ey.com/au/Parthenon. EY Parthenon, transformative strategy and transactions. Solutions that work in practice, not just on paper.
So how much further could unemployment rise?
Well, the Reserve Bank has forecast to go into 4.7%. Michelle Bullock back in May was asked, would she consider that 4.7 too high? And she said no. And She said, oh, it was their aim to keep unemployment in the fours.
Mm.
I worry that it will get up to 4.7% a bit quicker than they were expecting. Michelle Bullock in her press conference last week said it was higher than they anticipated, the April figures. So yeah, it is my worry. I don't think we're at a point where we need to quite panic, but we're already seeing youth unemployment start to rise pretty quickly, and that can sometimes be the old canary in the coal mine, because younger employed have less attachment to the workforce, they're less skilled, they're generally the last people who've been hired, and they're the first people to go. And that can be a sign that there's going to be other job losses to follow. We're not there yet, but I just wish the Reserve Bank was a bit more worried about that than they are about this wage price spiral, which, you know, hasn't happened in my working lifetime. So I'm not sure why they keep worrying about it.
How much could, you know, lower wages and potentially higher unemployment feed or further fuel the discontent that we know is brewing within parts of the community and that is contributing to political upheaval at the moment?
Yeah, really good question. Because this is, you know, when we look at what's happening with One Nation, and when you look at how the economy is talked about, how it's reported on, how the institutions, whether it be the government or the Reserve Bank, talk about it, it feels very disconnected from people's lives. And it almost feels like the workers are the ones who have to shoulder the burden. They're the ones who have to fix the problem through higher mortgage repayments, even though inflation's going up because of oil prices from something Donald Trump dreamed up.
Mm.
All you're really doing is just saying, no, you need to suffer a bit now so that you don't feel too good later on. And it's just like, wow, what an economy.
Mm.
And I think it gets felt by people that we are the ones, workers are the ones who are not being thought of when the elite institutions, whether it be the Reserve Bank or even governments, are talking about the economy.
Mm. Many people have been saying for many years that the antidote to the far-right populist surge is tackling that economic disenfranchisement and inequality that you've just described. We've covered a lot of ground. Thank you so much for your time, Grogs.
No worries, Noah. Always great to chat.
That was Guardian columnist and chief economist at the Australia Institute, Greg Jericho. You can find more of his work on theguardian.com, and we've linked to his latest column on the RBA on the full story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria and Miles Herbert. Sound design and mixing by Lou Hill. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. If you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also leave us a review. I'm Noor Haidar. Thanks for listening.
In a world of need, we need medical care. Without delay.
Delay.
Without bias. Without bureaucracy. Without prejudice. Without silence.
Civilians are not...
Save lives at msf.org.au.